I'm Richard Porter.
I'm Johnny Smith.
And this is Smith & Sniff, a podcast in which two friends talk about cars, and this week, the time Johnny almost died.
I've got to say, Rich, that two things that I forgot to mention last week. Mm-hmm. One, when I was clearing up the live show that we chatted about, and I won't go on about it because it sounds too self-congratulatory, which it's not supposed to be. It's just a case of surviving it. I was clearing up by torchlight, just making sure we hadn't left really obvious, expensive things lying around. And I realised, I looked at my watch and I realised that the hotel would probably stop serving food. I had a mild panic and decided there and then that by the time I get back to the hotel, all I'm going to get is, oh, sorry, sir, all you can have is a pint and a bar snack, which is okay, I'll take it over nothing. Yeah. But I was ravenous because we'd skip lunch, basically, hadn't we?
Yeah.
And to that end, I realised someone had bought me lunch and I'd never finished it and I'd held on to it for hours. So what I did was, and I'm going to put my hand in the air and say I'm not entirely sure this is right, but I found the bin liner I'd put it in.
Oh.
At the showground, and I opened it back up and it was still in there. And I carried on eating my dinner by torchlight on my own, and it was stone cold. Like the chips were turgid like a body that had been found three days later.
But this was it was sealed in a polystyrene.
It had been
container.
Shut up in the thing, and it had only been put in there maybe an hour and a half before by me, and I knew which bin liner it was because I'd arranged the bin liners.
But it was.
So is that a bit weird? Is that right? I ate out of a bin at my own event.
Bin food.
I ate bin food.
So you'd staged an inaugural live event with your name on it.
Yeah.
It went very well. You were the star of the show. You got to stand on stage and say, "Thank you, Kent. Good night." And, well, you didn't, but you could have done.
I could have dropped a mic and everything.
So you really were on a glorious high from a successful live event and adulation and all the rest of it. But once all the people had left, you were eating bin food in the dark.
Yes, but with a head torch. Yes, exactly.
I mean, it's a stark illustration of something or other. I'm not sure what, but at least you kept grounded. And then because I'd already gone at this point.
Yeah,
so I didn't get to see you.
You were racking up the beer.
Because your wife told me to go.
Yeah, she did. Yeah,
and she just went go get back to the hotel and get the beers in. And
yeah. And you did.
So I did. But then actually, because I got lost on the site, I didn't get back till after she was there and she'd already started securing the area in the bar to make sure I wanted to sit down. And then we had some food. And they were still serving by the time you got back.
Well, they were, which is really, I got angry about that because I was convinced there's no way they're going to serve food after that hour. And so I ate the bin and then consequently had to go back and eat some more food. So it's okay. I had a double portion.
I think I've eaten from the bin, though. Like,
tactically, not like tactless bin eating. I mean, that's just desperate.
Where it's sort of something in a packet where you take a call on how well sealed it is. You know, maybe my wife's thrown something away that she thinks we're not going to eat, and I'll go, oh, well, that's a waste, and I know I've done it.
So yeah, I do that.
I'm not going to take a moral high ground on bin food.
It's a dad thing, I think. I feel like it's a dad thing of like, come on, guys, we've thrown away.
I feel
like
it's more of a sort of dog thing. Food, don't care where it's been. Bin food. Mm.
I know what you mean. I do know what you mean. So I did do it. I'm not hugely proud. So that was one thing that I did. And the other thing I forgot to mention was I went for a sort of sanity walk, just for about an hour around the back of the fields where I live, just on my own.
When was this?
Off. This was a few days back.
Okay.
And I have to walk underneath a line of pylons.
Oh.
And every time I do it, the walk goes from sort of serenity, tranquility to there's an air of sinister about it.
Yes. Yes.
And the reason it always makes me remember those old 70s / maybe early 80s government warnings that you had on TV, where it was. Do you remember? It was a kid. Yeah. I think it was a kid called Jimmy playing with a frisbee near a pylon.
A frisbee, yeah. Yeah.
And then his sister or a girl he was playing with, he went, "Oh, it's caught up there. I'll go and get it." And she went, "Jimmy, don't do that. Jimmy, no.
Don't be suddenly, a dickweed, Jimmy." I might have said that. But
Well, kids now would just go, "Do you know what? I can't be arsed. I'll just order another one on Amazon." But anyway, Jimmy.
Well, they wouldn't be out there playing with a Frisbee anyway because they'd all be on Minecraft.
Well, they would, wouldn't they? Grumble. Strokers. But anyway, the
I called our kids shitbags this morning, not to their faces.
Oh,
but
I had to
get them out of the house, and while they were in the other room, I said to my wife, "I just need to get the shitbags out of the house."
Yeah, and I'm not surprised.
Often when I do things like that, she goes, "Don't call them that," but she didn't. She just agreed with me.
Oh, I've called them way worse.
It's like we've reached that summer holiday point where it's like they're just shitbags. Lovely shitbags. Fruit of our own loins, shitbags.
Well, that's the problem with summer holidays. It's they're actually quite annoying. But anyway, we'll gloss over that. I kept thinking. I remember those adverts being very, very scary.
Very scary.
And there was a series of them, wasn't there? And I haven't seen them for many years. But I remember Jimmy getting electrocuted, and it's sort of, and like a synth, a really kind of Doctor Who-y kind of dark synthesizer, and then all you saw was like a steaming trouser leg on the feet on the floor in field, or smoking.
If you'd have pressed me, I'd have said a sort of smoking shoe, but that might be too comedic. I don't know. You're probably right. It was smoking trousers.
I don't know if anyone listening to this podcast knows what the hell we're talking about, but it's those old government telly adverts.
Yeah, there were the government safety films in the, must have been the 80s, but I think it was probably from the 70s.
Yeah, they just kept reviving them.
I feel like he was wearing flared trousers. I don't know. Your mind plays tricks, doesn't
flares.
It? He was
wearing flares. Because it was that era when we used to watch stuff at primary school, like Look and Read, and those sorts of educational telly shows. And there was always cheesecloth and flares in there, despite the fact that I was sitting there in 1985 going, "What's all that?
Like, why is this? I've got a digital watch on. What the fuck's this all about?"
Well, yeah, but of course you look at Top of the Pops
read.
And everyone's wearing tapered this and, you know, New Romantic that and...
Yeah, it'd gone quite thin, I suppose, hadn't it?
George Michael does. Yeah, George Michael isn't wearing flares in Wham, so what's going on here? But anyway. Mm. So, yeah, those government adverts terrify me. And to this day, obviously, I've never climbed a pylon to get a Frisbee down. I have climbed a pylon for a documentary for Discovery Channel many years ago.
Really?
They turned it off before I climbed it.
Oh, right, okay.
Yes.
Wow.
And
it
was
terrifying.
You've
got to climb a pylon?
I climbed a massive pylon. I had to stand at the top, lift my hands in the air and then do a piece to camera where
Holy
the cameraman was down below. I was quivering like... I mean, I had two safety straps with, the carabiners. So you sort of... You walk up two steps,
but you never trust
on.
Those things, do you? You kind of go, what if it's not been done properly?
And also, if I went up there with the carabiners, it makes me sound like I fought with the Gurkhas or something, doesn't it? I went up there with the carabiners, and we were fighting our ways.
I think the carabiners sounds like a sort of early 2000s indie band. They're a bit jaunty. They're a bit like the Wombats or something. They're a bit jolly, so people are a bit sneering about them because they're too chirpy.
I love the Wombats.
They've done some decent tunes. Yeah, I like the Wombats.
Wombats are very good.
Yeah. Yeah.
Oh, the Carabiners. Yeah, the Carabiners. Yeah, I've seen them at Nottingham Rock City. Yeah, they're excellent.
They're too chirpy.
The whole event
to have
was
even done
so
a peel
safe.
Session.
The whole event was incredibly safe. People were doing 10-foot base jumps.
No one can do much in the mosh pit because everybody's tethered to the floor. It's it sort of changes the dynamic a little bit. And when the lead singer tries to stage dive, he just goes, "Okay," and then gets yanked backwards towards the drum riser.
Because he's on a tight lead.
Because he's lashed down.
Those dog leads that retract really quickly.
I can't believe you climbed a pylon, though. I'm sort of weirdly jealous of that. That seems like a very cool thing to do.
It was really cool. It's on the internet somewhere now, but it was a very old discovery. But yeah, I did. I got to how to climb a telegraph pole with sort of spike shoes on before that.
Oh,
and then I'm.
But they
and
have
then
those.
I might,
they have those foothold things, though, don't they? Or do they not?
They do, but some of them don't. Some of them are just a telegraph pole, and you have to wear shoes with special spikes, like spurs almost.
Wow.
And you dig them in a certain angle to climb to the top. And then, yeah, so I kind of went to a telegraph pole climbing school and then went and did this full on. Yeah, this pylon was huge. I think it's like a three tier. You can get like two tier pylons and no, one tier, two tier and three tier. And I did a three tier.
Oh.
And then took my hands off in the air at the end.
Do you know what pylons remind me of up close? Because I find that there's, you're
space
right,
invaders.
There's something intimidating about them. No, not Space Invaders. Do you remember the 80s TV series, The Tripods?
Yes, I do.
Pylons remind me of huge robots come to oppress humanity. Because there's something big and imposing about them, and yet there's a sort of elegance to them. They're fascinating close up. Like, they look quite cool from a distance. And then when you get up close, it's like getting. Do you ever, when you're a kid, and I'll be honest, even now, and I'm 46, I get quite a thrill from seeing the bottom of a cooling tower.
Oh, completely.
Because they're almost like Muppets. Cooling towers are like Muppets. You don't often get to see the bottom bit. You see them from a distance, the top bit. That's all you're meant to see. And then every so often, you get to see the bottom bit, and it's quite thrilling.
Yeah, yeah. Oh, yeah, absolutely. I can still
remember the first time I saw the bottom of a cooling tower. You go, oh, my God, they're sort of like, and they're on sort of legs almost. And there's
they're stood off the ground.
Yeah. I never understood, and maybe someone listening who's a, you know, some kind of thermodynamics expert can explain this, but I never understood why they didn't put sort of huge fans in the top of cooling towers that would be turned by the rising steam and had a dynamo in them to create a little bit of extra electricity.
Well, or you use the steam to, like, warm the surrounding houses and towns.
Yeah.
Which is basically what they do in Scandinavia.
Is it?
I suspect it's because people in Scandinavia are just fundamentally more clever than we are.
Well,
in the 70s, we genuinely didn't give a shit.
No, we didn't give a shit. But it's the thing, it's always struck me as quite wasteful, all that steam that pisses off into the atmosphere. But,
it has to be.
But yeah. Well, I think the thing about Scandinavia is it's like, again, maybe a listener can confirm. I know we've got some listeners in Scandinavia that there's a sort of fundamental sort of different mindset that might be related to living in an environment that can kill you. I don't know.
Yes. What, it's the survivalist instinct.
Yeah, well, it's that thing. I went to Arjeplog, where they do a lot of car testing in northern Sweden.
Yeah.
And someone pointed out to me that all the houses, because there's a lot of lakes around there, that's why the car industry goes there, because there's loads of lakes. They freeze in the winter, they can create, ABS and traction control calibration test facilities.
I've driven a Scania truck on ice.
Have you?
With a full trailer. Yeah, and I don't even have a truck license.
Did you skid
it? Awesome. Yeah, they wanted me to. They wanted me to get it into a full whip.
Bloody hell.
I know, it was brilliant.
I was once in a tractor unit, no trailer, just a you know, sort of four-wheel tractor unit, not driving, and did a, you know, barreling onto a split friction surface, and then the driver hammered the brakes and we did a 360, almost 360. He went, if I've done a good one, we'll get 360 out of this, but it's, you know, it's not always a given. So he really went for it, and we did it twice, I think, because first time we did about a sort of 270, and he went, no, I could do better than that. And
You get a big lateral whip in the cab because you're 10 feet.
Holy mother of God. Well, it feels like you're going over. But it's weird. It feels like you're going over sideways. I thought it might be, you know, we're going to just go onto our nose. But no, because it starts to spin and then it just feels like you're going to topple sideways. Because the cab's suspended, isn't it? So
the cab's suspended. It exaggerates. You do get a very strong whip on.
Yeah, God. It was exciting. And the second time I was a bit less frightened than the first because I was sort of felt like probably we're going to be all right. This guy's it's an old guy I used to know called Nick who used to test these things for a living. And we did it at Myra. Irrelevant details. what was I saying? Oh, yeah, no, so in...
where were we going?
In northern Sweden. No, they leave... Someone pointed out that all the houses, particularly if they're near the edge of the lakes, they leave a light on all the time. There's always a light on in those houses, and it's because if anyone got lost out on the lake when it's frozen or in the woods or anything like that, you just do your bit to help the possibility that a stranger might be lost out there to find their way to civilization.
They do have real candles or electronic candles in the windows. Yeah, so the curtains are slightly open. And you know what? At night when you're driving past, I just think it's so beautifully warming. And I know it's to do it's to do with that whole homely thing. And as you say, if there's someone out and they're in danger or they're lost, they can just follow the light, Jimmy. Follow the light.
Yeah. And I always think by extension, a lot of Swedish music and art or whatever has a sort of slightly wistful quality, perhaps, that might be inspired by the fact that a lot of the time in Sweden you're either nice and warm looking out at the bitter cold or out in the bitter cold looking at the nice and warm, and either way that brings a certain vibe to it.
Completely you're making it, just as conversations making me miss Sweden and Norway. I miss them a lot. Oh, so good. Yeah. Well, like I said, I've got an affinity towards them, especially towards Norway, because I nearly die in there. I suppose I feel quite affectionate towards it.
What, is that where you nearly died on the oil rig?
Yeah. So that's where I ended up getting airlifted back to hospital in Kristiansund.
Yeah.
And that's where I lived in hospital for a while. And my friend, the researcher I was working with on the TV show, kindly put a huge pile of printed pornography on the bedside table. And I was oblivious to it because I was out of my mind. For 3 days, I had nurses coming to my bed and tending to me, and I didn't realise I had Euro porn stacked on the side of the bed. I was so embarrassed because I was nil by mouth for whatever it was. It was 2 days, I think. It felt like 20 days. But
for people who haven't heard this story, what was it? Your appendix had gone.
My appendix ruptured while I was on an oil rig in the middle of the, was it the North Sea? Atlantic. And on an oil rig. And, of course, to get permission to film on the oil rig, this was a Shell oil rig, to get permission to film on it took months, and this was for Discovery Channel. We were going into the inner workings of it. It's a single-legged one. Look it up. It's called the Draugen platform. It looks like a silly bird table, but it's absolutely massive.
Yeah. And I always wonder how those stay up. They do look a bit like they might just topple over.
Oh, it's ridiculous. And it sways. It's built to flex.
It?
Yeah, because it has to sway with the current of the ocean, otherwise it would snap.
But, sway with the current of the oceans.
Oh, yeah. I know I apologise if people have heard this story before, and I'll gloss over it quickly. But, yeah, I basically thought I had major indigestion. We got there. We landed on the air, We landed on the helipad. You had all your survival suit on for the full journey in case the copter goes down. And then it's 45 minutes offshore. And we were ravenous. We got there, and the kitchens on this rig were just unbelievable. You know, like crab, the best fish I've ever eaten. Beautiful food. Everyone's really welcoming. It's just wonderful. And we set up camp, and I basically thought I'd just eaten too much. And anyway, during, I think, day number three, the pain in my sort of stomach got to the point. Like, oh my gosh, I'm really not in a good way. I don't know what to do. And the medic on board was like, "Look, I can't help you if you need surgery. I've got a defibrillator and I've got some basic painkillers and stuff, but I can't do a great deal." And so anyway, I just kept taking painkillers, Rich, and filming. And then it got to the point where the director said, "You do realise, Johnny, every time you're walking up and down steps, you're clutching your side like an old wounded soldier." And I went, "Am I?" And they went, "Yeah, you are." Anyway, I went to bed, took some more painkillers, and I woke up in the middle of the night, and I was just in excruciating pain, and called the medic, and the medic went, "We've got to scramble the chopper because I think you've got a stomach ulcer or something like that." And they knew that I didn't have any history of it. And the storm was coming in, and there was a 50-50 chance whether the helicopter could land. Anyway, it managed to land, and I got even worse because the vibration of the helicopter taking me back to land, it was all a bit of a blur, but yeah. Basically, I landed, was met by, I do remember it was a Mercedes ambulance, and then it took me to this little hospital. Doctor came, got out of bed and performed a surgery on me. They reckon I had 3 hours to live, so...
Bloody hell.
Quite bad peritonitis. I was gradually being poisoned, which is why I was starting to act very strangely, and it did feel like I was being stabbed. But Yeah, and I do remember, I have said this before, but I had to phone home at about 1 a.m. or 2 a.m. They wouldn't operate on me without me talking to a next of kin.
Oh.
So I phoned my wife, and of course she was in bed and she didn't answer her phone. Then I phoned my mum and dad, a landline, old school. Bless. My mum picked up the phone, bless her, and I was in such pain. I just screamed down the phone. In hindsight, it was not a great idea. I just went, I'm in hospital. I've got to have serious surgery. I think I'm going to be okay, mum. I've got to go, bye. And it was like that. That was it.
Oh, shit.
Yeah. And by the way, I'd say 20 seconds before that, I'd been fingered by a nurse.
What?
Yeah, they had to check my prostate. So I had a nurse putting her fingers in my jacksy whilst telling me I needed to phone my mum. The whole thing was very confusing. Anyway. So, yeah, interesting times.
If you've just joined us, you're listening to Britain's number one car podcast, where Johnny's explaining how he had his ring fingered by a Norwegian nurse shortly before phoning his mum on the landline.
It was absolutely true.
Anyway, back to electricity pylons.
That's what we started with.
Yeah, and I was going to say, I remember the last time I went under the cables between two pylons was a while back last year. We were on holiday in Norfolk and I went for a run and I ran under some cables and I ran like Billio when I got under the cables because it freaked me out and I thought I was going to get electrocuted.
Were they crackling?
It was drizzly and they were crackling like fuck.
Yeah, I know. It's there. You can really feel the power. You can sense the power. And my son always says, "What if the cable broke?" Because the fields at the back of ours, the pylons go diagonally across. We do periodically get the helicopter coming round, the National Grid helicopter, and it does that tight circle round each one, and it looks at it with ultra. What is it? Is it infrared? It scans it with infrared.
Oh, does it?
Because it can tell if there's any high resistance areas.
Oh, because it gets hot? Maybe?
Yeah, and it's, or it's if there's a rupture of one of the insulators or the isolator. And I believe, and I might be wrong, if there's a listener who knows way more than I do, which wouldn't be difficult, they can correct me. But I think what they do is it's always post-storm. They just check the tension of the wires and they check if there's any areas of high resistance. But it's always freaky watching a helicopter going very close to cables.
Yeah.
You just think, what could possibly go wrong?
My godfather, my Uncle Alwyn, he's a top man in a number of ways, but he's retired now, but he was an engineer for Manweb when that was one of the electricity companies in Britain.
I remember Manweb.
He used to go out and have to check cables sometimes, and he was quite afraid of heights. And sometimes there was a thing, I think, he said once he got sent up and he was like on a little basket actually going along the cable.
You're joking.
Which he didn't enjoy at all.
No.
So I tried to make sure he never had to do it again. But the exciting thing I remember him telling me when I was a kid is that they used to have some Ford Transit 4x4s.
Oh.
Do you remember those? I think it was an aftermarket jobby, but sort of endorsed by Ford.
I remember the Dodge Renault. The Dodge Renault.
Yes.
Ones, which
they were very,
very
popular with electricity companies, weren't they?
Yeah, they looked really good. In fact, you've just given me a strange flashback. I had a poster of one of those in my room because my dad.
What?
My dad worked with a company, I think, who had a fleet of them. And one of those things, it must have been in the summer holidays, which is relevant to now, where you know some kids end up having to go to work with their parents for a day or so when you just can't get. And I think I went to work with Dad and we did a site visit and they had a fleet. I remember they had a fleet of various things like cherry pickers and all that stuff. And when we went into the office, which was basically a porter cabin full of blokes smoking, I remember that they knew I was into cars and my brother was into trucks and stuff. And they gave me a poster of one of those Dodge Renault 4x4s. You know, it's where, and I know it must have been a promotional thing by Renault Dodge because it was all, there was a guy hanging off it, I don't know, with like a ladder, and there was another guy with a cherry picker, and it was all staged.
Yeah.
And actually another day on that summer holidays, Dad took us to, and it makes it sound so glamorous, he took us to a landfill site, and we got to ride on one of those big bulldozers which have metal wheels. I don't know if you've seen them.
Bulldozers with metal, well, not tracked.
No, it's not tracked. They've got four individual wheels, but they're metal, and then they've got metal kind of spikes or webs, paddles, metal paddles, and they drive over and over and over landfill. And then they do have a scraper on the front where they can level stuff off or push stuff in. And we spent the day on this landfill site, and I got a go in one. And I got a poster of one of those. And I mean, what sort of a kid was I? I had a poster of a work van and a landfill bulldozer on my wall. But I think it was just because I got given a poster and I just put it up. I don't think I didn't have a Lamborghini Countach with dry ice. I had a landfill bulldozer, which was a Caterpillar, I think, Cat Diesel.
I had some.
Can you compete with that, Rich? Shit.
Well, yeah, because I think I did have. I had at one point the classic Countach and a Testarossa, separate posters, but both, I think, cars in profile, a lot of dry ice.
Loads.
But then, obviously, I mean, that's sort of standard.
That was then, iconic.
I had at one point, they ran a series of newspaper adverts for the BMW 7 Series in the 80s. You know? I don't know why. I wasn't a particularly massive like BMW fan, but I just thought the ads were really cool because I think they ran them on consecutive days, and it was the car sort of getting, like, from memory, it was on a sort of, you know, on a desert on the and this is like,
of course it was,
and the car was getting closer and closer to the camera. I think this was the E32. This is like the mid 80s,
yeah.
You know, sort of new. So the one that replaced the classic shark nose,
mm-hmm.
7 Series, and I had those sort of stuck on my wall as a sequence, so the car got closer and closer. And then there was a newspaper ad, sort of mid to late 80s, when Rover was owned by British Aerospace. They ran these newspaper ads to announce, sort of, you know, basically going, "Oh my God, we've made some money for the first time." If anyone can remember, bloody hell, Rover's made some money. What the fuck? I think that might have been the headline. What the fuck?
Yeah,
but it was like, it was this big, it was a really dry advert. I don't think it even had cars on it. It just had a big announcement that, like, Rover Group was on the up. Things were going well. And I cut it out and stuck it to my wall.
Did you?
Yeah. It's a bit weird.
See, we were a weird pair of swines, weren't we?
I know.
We were destined to do great things with a microphone.
Yeah.
Like talking about 70s boys climbing pylons for a plastic disc. And
yeah,
then
I was
going to
say before, I'll find that 70s pylon safety advert and put it out on the links for patrons, and also your Discovery Channel pylon climb. If I had more time, I'd fire up Final Cut and edit the two together so it looked like it was you in the safety advert, but I'm afraid I'm quite busy.
Oh, that would be great. Johnny, no!
Maybe I'll put them up and somebody else could do that. If they're so inclined, I
was going to say, if there's any
deadlines looming,
if there's any listeners who remember any other weird governmental ads, this could be in other countries too, because obviously we only remember the British ones. But
I bet
some of them were awful, like very scary and sinister, and perhaps unnecessarily so, or badly acted.
I've just looked up the Ford Transit four-wheel drive models from the past. It's called the Ford Transit County.
Oh.
Who remembers that?
Oh, hang on. Well, the County Ford tractor was a logging tractor. And I bet
really?
That is... Oh, yeah. In fact, gosh, this is almost like relevant to current affairs in the automotive world. There was the most expensive tractor ever sold at auction a few weeks back was a county logging tractor. Let me find... Yeah, it made the...
The most expensive tractor ever sold at auction.
Yeah, so it's a second... As in not new, as in a second-hand, you know, classic tractor. Here we go. It was on the... it was on the news. Here
really?
We go. Yeah.
What did it go for?
Oh, I'll show you. Hang on, I'm just clicking on it. I'm just clicking on the launch...
While you're finding that, I'll just tell you there's a website devoted to the Transit County. TransitCounty4x4.co.uk. The reason it's called a county, actually, not to do with the logging tractor, is because, although it says a handful of companies offered 4x4 conversions for transits since it was launched in 1965, the most popular of which was provided by County Tractors of Knighton in Powys, who converted vans on behalf of Ford Special Vehicle Operations as a factory option, starting with the Mark II.
Does it look great?
It does look great. With the introduction of the Mark III Transit in 1986 came a new generation of County 4x4, which proved to be very popular and successful. The last to use the beam axle layout. Yeah. So,
do you know?
Yeah.
Yeah, that's there the smiley go. Face Transit, isn't it? The Mark
III.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. According to the ITV News website, this was on the 6th of July, so it is current affairs. I will class that as current affairs.
Yeah.
Rare vintage tractor from family collection sells for record amount in Essex auction. The 1983 County 1474 short nose was bought by a UK collector. This rare tractor only had two owners from new with 100 hours on the clock, which is not a lot. It smashed its pre-sale estimate. It was estimated between 60 to 70 grand, and it sold for £210,000 £112,000. I need to now say that properly. I'm so shocked because if you look at the picture of it, I remember the County tractors because they had
£2,100,000 basically. If you're going to express it in confusing ways,
exactly. So yeah, £210,000 for an '80s. Sort of looks like a logging tractor, and I remember Counties were logging tractors because they had the same size wheels at the front as the back, and they often had an external roll cage, although this one doesn't have one. But yeah, £210,000. £210,000. Yeah,
so that's like the Bugatti Royale of tractors.
I think it is actually
250 GTO.
I like tractors, as you know, but I don't have an enormous amount of knowledge on them. But if anyone's listening who will know why that tractor is so rare, I kind of want to know. But it was sold by Cheffins Auctioneers, which to me just sounds like you're about to say a rude word and you have to modify it because a child walks in the room.
That's the kind of word that your grandparents would use to avoid swearing, isn't it?
Oh absolutely. My...
Some rabbits have got into the Cheffin allotment again.
It was completely... Oh, yeah, Grandpa smashes his thumb with a hammer while someone was talking to him.
Cheffin!
Oh, for the hurts. World of Cheffins, what's going on? Fetch me a cup of tea. My thumb's the size of Tina Turner's downstairs. Oh, gosh, quick.
Yeah, just a whole... This probably is. There's a whole sort of load of... like pre-war not swear words that have been lost to time. Yeah, Cheffin Bronkel. What's that mean? Oh, it's very rude if I said the real words.
I mustn't say it.
You're going to have to help me out.
Here we go. It was hosted by East Anglian-based auctioneer Cheffins at Shearing in Essex. You could just say all of those words together. Cheffins at Shearing in Essex. I've just Cheffin fallen Shearing. Down those steps with brogues on.
Cheffin idiot. He's knocked the shearing lamp over. All right, Grandma, calm down.
Maybe all auction houses are actually... like, I don't know, 1940s not swearing words. Maybe that's the thing. That's their secret code.
Actually, also for full sort of strange grandparentness, not my grandparents are long dead, but I've observed this in other people's grandparents, and it's wonderful when they also use words for things that's a sort of not comprehensible. Do you know what I mean? When okay, mind it, you'll knock over the frontispiece. And you go, what the hell is that? I don't know what that means.
Oh, the thingamy. Yeah, there's always the thingamy.
Well, the thingamy, yes. Well, obviously, yes. Words that are sort of placeholders because you can't remember the real word.
That's the dongoloid. Watch out. Don't touch the dongoloid. It's hot.
Yes.
It's hot, I'm telling you. Granny, why is the dongoloid glistening? Don't touch it.
Don't. Just go to the other room and get the Frimsby for me. The Frimsby. And I don't know what that is. Don't know what that is at all.
With the dangalang, yes. Fetch the dangalang from the shed. I just don't know.
Not the old one. The electric one. There's an electric one now. Your grandfather got it in 1956.
Your late grandfather got it. It's still in the box.
Yes, it's a Brigsby Super Special. Bring it in here. I don't know where that's come from, but what were we just talking about?
Oh, I don't flipping know.
No.
Oh, we're talking non-swear words.
Oh, non-swear words.
Wartime non-swear words.
Oh, a chap at the live show the other weekend gave me quite a good idea, and I'm sorry, I don't think I even took his name, but he said, you know, there's that thing where anyone mentions the Reliant Scimitar and people just immediately go, oh, Princess Anne's got one, you know.
Mm.
But he said you could sort of broaden that out into car word association and just things, the first word or thing that pops into your head when you say a certain car.
Oh.
And I thought that is quite good.
That's not bad.
It's quite a...
What, could we do that? Is that a... isn't word association... Wasn't that what Timmy Mallet did? Wasn't Mallet's Mallet the children's
TV? Was it word
TV
association?
Game? That was a word association game.
Without hesitation.
Without any hesitation.
I mean, yeah, without hesitation.
Yeah, that's exactly what it was.
But could you just say any old shit, or did it have to have some kind of link?
It had to have relevance. So, yeah, you'd say tyre, I'd say, I don't know,
wheel.
Air or wheel,
yeah.
Or tread or rubber.
Yeah, you couldn't just say clouds.
No, I couldn't just say Cheffins. No, because someone would go, I'm sorry, it's just not, I don't see the connection there. No, it's Dangaloid. No, it's not Dangaloid.
Well, what if Cheffins is like the... you know, the blank bit on a certain dominoes or the blank tile in Scrabble. You can use it for anything.
Oh, a Cheffin.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, that would
be good.
Get
out of jail. Yeah.
I do quite like that, actually.
Celery. Cheffin. Oh, okay, then. You're allowed one.
Gosh, you've
one
won
per game.
Cheffin. I don't play professional poker, but if I did, I would love there to be a Cheffin option.
I don't think you get wild cards in poker.
I think we talked about this, not on the podcast. I can't remember, but you know these professional where they film professional poker games, which again I don't entirely understand. I'm not sure that's very exciting, but it seems that the choice of sunglasses of some of the players, they just do it on purpose. They just pick very ill fitting sunglasses, don't they?
They always look like they've bought them from a petrol station on the way there.
On the way there, that's exactly.
Well, maybe they have. That's the thing. They've gone right. And my special eye concealing sunglasses. Oh no, I've left them at home. Oh, shit, there's a petrol station over there. I'll go in. And it's one of those petrol stations as well. It's not BP or Shell or Esso.
Oh, it's a no-name.
It's one of those weird
station.
Like no name. Yeah. Where you kind of go, Squilliam? Do they make petrol? Where's your petrol come from? And it's like I almost filled up at one of those the other day because I was running very low and I was sort of not near brand name petrol. And in the end, I didn't because I always worry that their fuel's got bits in it or something.
No, I like the no name fuel stations. I tend to like those.
You know, they often look like independent businesses, and I'm also for supporting those. But at the same time, I do just worry that they're basically selling shit petrol.
But if you base it on the fact that they're selling out of date sunglasses where everyone looks like they're from the Matrix off of the 90s, but also they've probably got a basket right by the till which still has CDs in.
Yes.
And right at the bottom of that basket is the odd stray cassette. And you kind of do a double take. You go, oh my gosh, it's a basket full of CDs. That's amazing.
Yeah. Quite often, a big wall rack of batteries and other items. But all of the packaging is the old design. You just go, oh God, I haven't ever ready. Are they still going? God, I just hadn't really thought. It's they're very, very mysterious places.
Time warp.
Rural off-brand petrol stations.
I like that.
I do enjoy them, though, if they have a used car lot attached, which they often do.
You've got to go straight for the trade-ins.
Yeah.
You've got to go straight to the back. You see, those sorts of car lots, you start at the back and you work your way to the front, because the ones at the front are the ones they want you to see. And I'm not interested in those. I always go to the back of the ones that they haven't quite prepped yet, or they're trying to hide from public eyes. And they go, oh, yeah, that one's definitely broken. Put it at the back.
When I was a kid, when I was sort of probably about 12 or something, we stopped at one of those kind of places in Devon on the way back from a family holiday. And for
Devon
some reason,
Cheffin,
I got out
he's
the
a
car.
He's a good
and I
guy.
Spotted, just this Cheffin's petrol station. But I got out of the car and I spotted round the back of the used car lot what looked like some interesting sort of, but dirty moss-covered stuff. And I said, there was a guy there, and I went, excuse me, can I go and look in the scrapyard round the back? And he went, it's not a scrapyard. And oh, they were that was the trade-ins, I think. That was all the...
That would have been trade-ins.
Grubby.
He was about to smother them.
It was a BMW 2002, I remember that.
He was about to smother them in tyre black and and pledge.
Yeah.
And then suddenly they all look really good. Once they've had a jump pack thrown on them, and they're off choke. That was always the thing. I remember going past those sort of old car lots, and there was one in the village where I grew up, and in the morning there were a lot of cars sitting on choke because you knew that they'd come in, lifted the tailgate, and they got, we've got to make sure they all work in case someone turns up and goes, oh, what's the Mini like? And you just go, oh shit, we haven't run the Mini for 3 weeks.
Yeah,
it's going to have no hope of actually working bobbins. But yeah, I'm still trying to get over that county tractor being over 210,000 quid.
It's a lot for a tractor, isn't it? But
I kind of want to drive it now. A good friend of mine who was at the... in fact, that you've stayed in his caravan.
I met Lewis.
Of course, he deals in tractors. He would actually, I should have asked him before we recorded this. He'll know why that tractor's worth what it's worth.
I was curious about what is so special about it. But maybe... drop Lewis a note and we'll completely forget to come back to this, but it's always worth a go.
Hell, I'm going to plug it because he bought a Porsche tractor barn find to our show. I'm going to plug him. Chichester Farm Machinery, Lewis at Chichester Farm Machinery, top guy, good friend of mine, and we've been to some places and seen some things. Yeah, I was going to say some of the things we've been to.
Yeah,
I just stopped there and think,
you told me a couple of things and I don't think we should share them.
No, I think it would harm his business, so no.
Well, I was going to say, talking as we were about 1980s public information films warning you not to climb pylons, and it sort of put the fear of God into you, but then at the same time, I've never had a pylon-related disaster. What I was going to say before is it's sort of... I'm going to bracket this alongside those other things which, as a kid, I sort of believed might be the thing that killed me. And in adult life, I realised that they're not really a threat, like rabies or quicksand.
Oh, quicksand. I mean, it doesn't exist in Britain, does it?
But when you're a kid, didn't you honestly believe like that quicksand was one of the things that might eventually get you? Because it seemed like it was a sort of... simmering distant threat through probably not public information films, but just sort of playground chatter and maybe something you'd seen in a textbook.
It would have been, I think it was a Sunday afternoon films that your parents watched. There was always a woman dying in quicksand.
Yes.
And the last thing you'd see would be the arm with the hand still moving as it disappears. Yeah. And I used to think, I know it's not real because it's a film, but how have they actually done that?
That's a good point, actually, because special effects-wise, that'd be a right bastard to do.
Yeah, she got a goldfish bowl over her head, and she's just got a little chamber of air in there.
I reckon if you looked at those shots, they're probably quite close up, and it was just a big box with wet sand in it, and there's a hole through the side of the box through which you can put your arm. That would be how I think about doing it, and just do quite a tight shot of the hand. Don't do like a massive wide of the whole beach. With a one hand. That would be hard.
Right.
I mean, it'd be easy these days because you just, do it against a green screen and drop it into a bigger plate shot. But, that's how I think they might do it.
Right.
Otherwise, I don't think you could actually bury someone and then get them. We'll be really quick, okay? Promise, really quick. Or there's a straw. There's just a straw goes up so they can breathe.
Oh, it could be the straw.
Hide it behind a bush.
It could be a straw, which I know that foxes do that to deflee themselves, don't they? I still think that's an amazing fact. I love nature anyway, but yeah, foxes, they snap off a bulrush. I think it's a bulrush, which has a hollow stem.
Mm.
And they breathe through it, and they basically walk backwards into a shallow part of a river or a lake.
What?
And they stay underwater for I don't know, 5 minutes, maybe 10 minutes, using it as a snorkel because they know that's what gets rid of things like fleas. They deflee themselves that way.
Give over. Foxes.
Yeah, they do.
All foxes. What if the fox doesn't have access to a body of water.
Well, I'm guessing also a thick fox probably hasn't thought of it, but other foxes.
Now this is
something
I promise I'm not making this up.
I promise.
This puzzles me, right? In I would say the spectrum of human intelligence is pretty broad.
Yes,
you get some people who are mind-bogglingly stellar brains that will, you know, solve problems and do molecular physics and all sorts of stuff, and, you know, shining stars of what is humankind's potential. And at the other end, you get some right dimwits, like those absolute fucking morons who turned up at TV Centre the other day to protest about vaccinations or something because they thought the BBC still lives there, even though it hasn't for about 6 or 8 years.
Oh no,
and you
really?
Kinda go, yeah, and you kind of go, that's the, you know, that's the full spectrum of human intelligence. It's broad, and that sort of is where we are as a species. But animals, it's like, do you get stupid animals and do you get really clever animals, or are they all just sort of broadly about the same?
I'd like to think you get thickies, because it was you that said in it not that many podcasts ago that owls are actually quite thick, even though they're depicted in cartoons and stories as being a wise bird. They're actually not a wise bird, which I thought is really funny.
No,
So I think maybe there's other animals out there that we still haven't clocked are actually exceedingly clever that we just dismiss very early on.
But then also, you know how, like, on the one hand you get human beings who are incredibly coordinated and have fast reactions, you know, a lot of sports people or jet pilots, spokespeople. And at the other end you get someone like me who struggles to catch a ball and is generally absolutely useless at sport, you know, it has no coordination of any particular use.
Yeah.
And I just think you don't get that same range with animals. They're all generally, like, you just don't get kind of clumsy cats, or do you? Or like,
yeah, you do. You know. Yeah, yeah, I've had a clumsy cat.
Really?
Yeah, I've had a cat that couldn't jump up onto anything. It just kept misjudging it, and it would slip straight off or go over the other side. Yeah, but he was a Persian, so, and I think Persians are not quite as good because they're not reared up to survive in the same way.
Because I was going to say, I think, you know, sort of within dog breeds, I think it's sort of agreed that some dog breeds are more intelligent than others, perhaps.
Yes.
And they certainly have, the different breeds have different characteristics. But I'm talking about within the same breed. So, you know, all of the things being equal, are some dogs or cats more coordinated and more intelligent than others? Like, even with the same family, you know, same litter of puppies, could you get, like, a really smart one and a really stupid one? But maybe the really stupid one's really good at catching sticks and the really clever one just constantly running into trees by mistake. I don't know. That's the thing. There's definitely.
It's a bit like, you know, we're in the car world where people go, oh, yeah, you want to buy one of those because they're cockroaches, they're indestructible, they're built like brick shit houses, blah, blah, blah. Mm. There's always going to be one that's not very good.
Yeah.
I know people that have bought, I bought a brand new Honda in the 90s because everyone said that they would never go wrong. Mine went wrong three times in the first 4 months of buying it when it was brand new. I know people like that. And you're like,
no,
you're
always
the only one.
Be.
You must be the only one in the world who bought a 90s Honda that went wrong. But
well, that's what they I've heard said, that in terms of the mass manufacturing of cars, the word quality at a manufacturing level just means repeatability, doing the same car over and over again to the same standard, and that standard should be high. But occasionally quality goes wrong for whatever reason, and you get, you know, what used to be called a Friday afternoon car come off the line.
Oh, hell yeah.
Do you remember years ago we did a thing on Top Gear where we drowned a Toyota Hilux pickup and dropped it?
It's one of the best things I think Top Gear's ever done. I absolutely loved
that.
Yeah,
it was one of those ones.
Transfixed.
I think that was one of those films that sort of progressed the show to the thing that it became, because that was quite early on, and it was one of those ones where it's like, no one's done this before to this level, and it feels like we're sort of, you know, we're standing out a bit. And but the guy who came along on that shoot, who you see on camera after it gets pulled out of the Bristol Channel, the mechanic who came along was a Toyota mechanic from Toyota themselves, and he was their sort of top technician in the country, and his job was, if you had a duff Toyota or Lexus and you'd been back to the dealer and they couldn't crack a problem with it, they parachuted him in. Because they're, you know, obviously they're quite precious about their reputation of making reliable cars. So if there was a particularly knotty problem that was out of character for their general sort of reputation, they'd just parachute him in and try and get it sorted out, because there was nothing they reckoned he couldn't sort. And, you know, he was the guy who, with just a really basic bag of tools and some WD-40, got that bloody pickup running after it had been dunked in the sea.
It had had a full tide come in and go back out again. I mean, bloody hell.
Yeah.
That was one of the things. I'm probably going to ask you this in a future Q&A live audience. But yeah, how much TV trickery was behind that Hilux?
Nothing.
You didn't secretly put new heads on it and change pistons.
No, there's nothing you didn't see on camera. Pretty much that he just
drained all the fluids.
We knew what we wanted to do with it broadly, and that's why we used the diesel one. We were advised, use the diesel, not the petrol, because it will be easier to resuscitate.
Yeah.
So that was the one sop to sort of trying to make sure it did come back to life. But otherwise, no, it was all a bit of a crapshoot. And particularly because I remember we got the call in the office, we've lost it. It's gone in the sea. It's broken its tethers. It's gone. And we were like, oh, fuck. Well, that's it. We're going to have to sort of scrap the
really?
Or start again. Yeah. And then as the tide went down, it reappeared and it sort of dug into the sand.
Because it was chained. It was chained down, wasn't it?
It was chained, but it had broken one of the chains or both the chains. I think it must have just broken one of them. So then it sort of it got washed away to the length of the other chain. I forget. But
bloody hell.
Yeah.
I mean, it's remarkable even when you describe it. And I know what happened, but it's still remarkable.
Yeah, it was. And then what else did we do to it? I can't remember.
You dropped it. You demolished a block of flats, and it was in the on the top. Or
yeah, that was the follow up, I think, wasn't it? Because James did that one, and that
Jeremy. Yeah. Jeremy obviously drove it around a lot, like down flights of stairs, and
I was thinking about that when I was in Bristol the other week.
And yeah, was it in Bristol?
It was in Bristol.
It was, wasn't it?
And we got into a lot of bother because he drove it into a tree, which was by a church, and the vicar was very cross that we chipped the bark off the tree, which, you know, in fairness, that was a bit moronic. But then we drove it down some steps, and it had a tow bar on it. A tow bar, as it went down the steps, the tow bar clanked every step and took a chip out of it. And that went down badly as well, which, again, is sort of fair enough. We're sort of smashing up Bristol. Which I hadn't been to Bristol for years, and I went the other week, and I'd forgotten how goth Bristol is.
Oh, Bristol's brilliantly goth.
I haven't seen so many white guys with dreads for years. It's amazingly so. It's not even goth, it's sort of Grebo-y kind of city. It's like it's got its own thing going on. It's not paying attention to the rest of the country.
Well, I think it's got a 90s quarter. I think you know cities have the jewellery quarter and the Latin quarter, yes, or whatever. I think Bristol has still got the 90s quarter, and it's not signposted at all. And I say this with charm, because, you know, I grew up in the West Country and I know, but as someone who didn't grow up in the West Country, my wife, when we first started going out and she started coming down to see my parents and spend some time there, she's said long before, she goes, what is with the Southwest and the 90s? She said, it's almost like you sort of took it and you held on to it. And it's true. The more she said it, the more I realised, yeah, bloody hell.
Is it? You know, they say that men particularly sort of find a hairstyle and a style of dress at some point in their lives and then just stick. It's like you can stick or twist and you just go stick.
You can anchor. Yeah, you can put your anchor down, can't you?
And is it the same with Bristol, that it got to a point, and I think the 90s is quite apt, because I guess in the 90s, the Bristol music scene kind of broke through to the mainstream, didn't it, with like Tricky and
Portishead, Massive Attack. It was powerful. It was a powerful music force.
And so Bristol sort of went, we've made it. Let's just stay exactly like this. And
I think it put its musical anchor down. Ronnie Size came along in the late 90s. He was a late anchorer.
Was Ronnie Size from Bristol?
I think so, yeah.
Okay. Yeah, I figure. I mean, it sounds like it's all sort of part of that.
And, of course, Thingy used to hang around in Bristol a lot, Goldie, and And Bjork, she hung around Bristol a bit, I believe. So although they weren't native Bristolians, yeah, it was a hive. Yeah. It was a musical hive. And I do think, I do think there's an unsignposted 90s quarter. And so,
excuse me, I'm looking to buy a Global Hypercolor T-shirt. Do you know where I go? Yeah, I just want to go around the corner there, mate, the 90s quarter.
Yeah, and do you know what? If there isn't a 90s quarter, there bloody well should be.
Well,
and when you go round there, you go and there's just E30 BMWs and Nissan Sunnies everywhere, and you suddenly go, hang on a minute, is this? This is all pre-internet, mate. You can't use. There's no 4G when you walk around this.
Yeah, well, suddenly your phone can't look at the internet. It's just a phone. The reception is terrible.
Yeah, you have to quickly just grab a big issue and that's it. You just read the big issue and you look at flyers. Yeah. Suddenly flyers are the oracle.
Loads of flyers, yeah.
There's flyers everywhere. I'd absolutely love that. Yeah, there'd be a Sierra just being flung around. And there's obviously a lot more on-street smoking.
A lot more.
Because vaping's banned from the 90s quarter because it doesn't exist. It's futuristic.
Exactly, yeah. you get your vape confiscated as you walk into the 90s quarter, but they hand you a pack of Marlboro Lights and a lighter. So
Yeah. But because 90s fashion has reared its head in various ways, the sort of Aztec weave hoodie has made a comeback.
Or even some kind of poncho. And here, have this bottle of alcoholic lemonade.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. So from the Aztec weave hoodie's made a renaissance. So that's allowed in again. The white man's dread, that's still a firm favourite.
That's definitely, I mean, that's happening as we speak in Bristol. I couldn't help but notice.
It just makes my head itch looking at it, but anyway.
Also, not specifically 90s, but an enduring favourite in that sort of, if you're going for that look, is army surplus clothing.
Of course. Of course there is. You've got
that's
to have the multiple pocket cargo.
Yeah, multi-pocket.
Pants.
Yeah. So
what about
possibly some kind of long coat.
What about the embroidered holster for the clipper cigarette lighter that goes around your neck?
Was that a thing?
Have you seen those ones? That was a thing. That was a thing in the 90s.
Well, you're going to need it now. You've had to hand in your vape.
Well, this is the thing because vapes are banned. It was a very popular rave accessory because, of course, lighters were a precious commodity in a field.
Yeah.
You lose a lighter. So it was a leather holster for a clipper refillable lighter attached to a shoe, I guess, essentially a leather shoelace, which would go on your neck as a necklace. And you could... I don't know why I'm saying this like a documentary maker,
Well, it almost
folklore.
Feels like you are.
I do remember seeing it.
Britain's foremost experts in
West Country
90s fashions, yeah. Professor Jonathan Smith.
I'll be like Brian Cox, but just talking about
the
cargo
90s
pants.
Were amazing.
Cavalier SRIs, yeah, brilliant.
Cargo pants.
I'd absolutely
very
love
useful.
That.
Don't knock them.
Yeah. I've been well into Golas and Maestro turbos. Yeah, wicked.
Well, now I feel like we've done an hour of chat and we've mentioned almost nothing to do with cars, which even by our standards is pretty amazing achievement. But it's too late now. Maybe we'll try and make amends next week by, I don't know, just having a brief canter through the Renault range or something. but we should probably wrap this
I think
one.
I'll talk about the BMW iX3 next week.
Oh, yes. Maybe we should touch on that. We had a look at it, didn't we, a few weeks ago at Goodwood?
Yeah. And maybe we'll go down a rabbit hole of people playing fretless bass on Instagram, which I seemed to watch about an hour of it last week when I was... and I don't even know why.
Anyway, before we go, I have three things to tell you. They are, one, Johnny has a solo YouTube channel called The Late Break Show. And, of course, there is The Late Break Show Live. The first one was a great success in Kent last week. And there's another one coming up on the 11th of September in Leicestershire. Details at thelatebreakshow.com/tour. Is that right?
Tour.
Embarked on that without doing my research, but there we go. Got away
with it. Well, you're good.
Two, I've got various books out. Why Not Try Steel Flies, a spoof Cold War thriller, supposedly written by the fake car journalist Roy Lanchester. Completely overuses the word muscular, sometimes rather out of context. And third thing I have to tell you is that Blame It on the Boogie wasn't written by the Jackson 5. But confusingly, it was written by a man called Mick Jackson, who is no relation to the Jacksons. He wrote it hoping to sell it to Stevie Wonder, and when Stevie Wonder passed on it, he recorded it himself. And when that went nowhere, the Jacksons picked it up and made it a massive hit.
Is it a terrible alibi, Blame It on the Boogie? Is it like...
Well, it's not quite as bad as Shaggy just going, it wasn't me.
Oh, yeah, despite CCTV evidence and... Yeah. That's clearly you, Mr. Shaggy. No, it's not me.
No, it wasn't me. But you're holding the bloodied knife. No, it wasn't me.
No, it's not me. No.
So didn't that woman. You record a song that said it wasn't me in the 90s? No, it wasn't me.
It'd be amazing as a KGB agent, Shaggy would, wouldn't he? Be brilliant.
Definitely wasn't me. Did you get a Salisbury? No, it wasn't me. Everyone saw you get on the train with your mate. No, it wasn't me. Definitely wasn't me.
Get on the train with your mate.
Anyway.
You know your mate who's definitely not a high-ranking corporal. Not me.
A known KGB agent to all the world's intelligence agencies. Nope, wasn't me.
We were just going to look at the chalk horse. That's all we were going to do. That sounds like... Are you sure that sounds like a euphemism? No. chalk horse. It's like a coat. It's like a calling sign, isn't it? It would be the other one at the other end. It'd be chalk horse to
Salisbury Cathedral, I suppose. Wasn't that
I'd be blue tack. Be blue tack warthog. Chalk horse to blue tack warthog. Come in. The smear is on the handle.
You need to stop talking now, because it's the end of the show.
It wasn't me, were the words that I told her.
Somebody else. We're picking up somebody else. Talking bollocks. If only we could use that excuse. Well, anyway, that's it for this show. Remember, it wasn't us. We'll see you again next week for more of this, where maybe it will be. But until then, thank you ever so much for listening. If you want to drop us a line, hello@smithandsniff.com. And we'll see you next week. Goodbye.
Goodbye. Sheffield.